Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. A retail job isn't really where you'd likely go to seek enlightenment. Alicia Gorder thought her stint at a small flower shop would be lovely and easy. But it didn't take long for her to realize that a flower shop is actually a conduit for deep emotions, the good, the bad, and the indescribable. Carrie Bechet reads for us this week. You may know her from roles in Netflix's Narcos and AMC's Halt and Catch Fire. She reads Alicia Gorder's essay, One Bouquet of Fleeting Beauty, Please.
On my first day of work at the flower shop, I showed up in sandals. The second day, realizing I needed something closed-toed, I wore my nice Oxfords. The third day, having learned that less fancy would be best, I put on a pair of red high-top Converse sneakers that I bought specifically for the job. The clean white toes and soles of my Chuck Taylors perfectly reflected my newness at the flower shop. How long it took me to put together bouquets, how I struggled to fold paper around loose stems in a way that was pretty, or at least presentable. It's like swaddling a baby, someone told me in an effort to be helpful, but I had never done that either. My dream of working in a flower shop had its roots in my grandmother's garden, always in bloom, where I made bouquets with whatever I could get my hands on. But that experience in no way prepared me for the number of buckets I would have to clean or the way dirt would wedge itself permanently under my nails. Mostly, though, I wasn't prepared for the people. From the man who handed out three flowers to three strangers every Tuesday, to the Thanksgiving guest who sent a bouquet to his hosts after walking off with one of their silver dinner knives in his pocket. Their stories wove their way into mine and stuck with me long after I locked up for the night. I always enjoyed reading the messages that went along with each bouquet. Most were what you would expect. Plenty of, I love you, and get well soon. We got so many happy birthday, happy anniversary, and thinking of you requests that phone messages were written in shorthand. HB, HA, TOY. But others had more flair, like farewell to your old boobs and hello to the new Megan. Or dear baby daddy Johnny, thank you for your powerful sperm. Once I took a phone order for a dozen yellow roses and a card that read, Sorry, I'm an idiot. Is that it? I asked. Sorry, I'm an idiot? From your duck, he added. Duck like the animal? Yeah. I would scoff at messages that seemed too sugary or boring, and it depressed me when customers asked what their sympathy cards should say. But I also understood that finding the right words can be a monumental task, and that sometimes those words just happen to be the same ones everyone else is using. About 6 months into the job, I came across a message that struck me for its frankness and honesty. It read, "Cards and flowers seem so lame when someone dies, but we are thinking of you and want you to know." I thought about that note a lot. When I was 18, my boyfriend of 2 years hanged himself from the rafters of his garage. He was the first boy I kissed, the first I loved, the last person I talk to at night and the first person I talk to in the morning. Until one sunny day in November when I woke up to a call from his mother. People sent cards. I don't remember what they wrote, but what mattered was the gesture. Maybe they said, "With our deepest sympathies," or, "We are so sorry for your loss." For me, it all came down to one word. Gone. After he died, I thought of his death as something that had happened to me. An act committed specifically with me in mind because of something I had or had not done. And it took me years to break free from this habit. By the time I started working with flowers, I had shed some of my cynicism and bitterness. I no longer wore his old t-shirts to bed and had given up on finding answers to impossible questions, most of which were versions of the relentless, "What could I have done?" There was always something, but at the same time, absolutely nothing. And I had learned to live with that. I had moved away and finished school and loved someone else. I was more open to people's pain and also their happiness, two states of being that used to equally irritate me. The pain because it hit too close to home, and the happiness because it seemed so far away. I became more interested in other people's stories, and the more I was confronted with life in all of its beauty and ugliness, the more I felt a softening in me. I have sold flowers to single men and women, to colorblind fathers shopping with their precocious daughters, to new parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, to engaged 20-somethings and couples celebrating 50 years. I've given flowers to homeless men who have in turn given them to pretty girls in summer dresses. Once I presented a cherry brandy rose to Extremo the Clown, a gray-haired, red foam-nosed character who drives the Never Never van around the streets of Portland, Oregon while blasting music and waving a monkey puppet out the window. People buy flowers when they're in love, in trouble, drunk, devastated, excited, and sometimes for no obvious reason. Only occasionally would I get to see how the story played out. I helped a young man buy flowers for a woman he was seeing, and he told me that he would soon be proposing to her on a trip overseas they were taking together. I remember him because he came in looking for the most fragrant flowers, stock, stargazers, tuberose. I spent 15 minutes with him walking around, taking whiffs of each flower. It was the first time I had bothered to smell a flower all day, even though I had been working for hours. 6 months later, he came back. Again, I pointed out the most fragrant flowers, watching as he buried his nose in the blooms, and listening as he told me about his wife, now pregnant. At first, I was blown away by the ease and regularity with which I was invited into customers' lives, but it quickly became the norm. "What's this for?" I would ask, because it was my job. "Anniversary. Birthday. Just because." But then sometimes, "This might be too much information, but I'm dating my ex-wife." And just like that, I would find myself in the middle of a discussion about what that's like, to date one's former spouse. I took notes on these conversations, snapped photos of card messages, and told my favorite shop stories to coworkers, family, and friends. But still, so much has gotten away. I have lost the post-its, or can't quite make out what my fragmented notes refer to. Details escape me, and sometimes it seems as if the harder I try to hold on to them, the more blurry they become. But the beauty, I learned, was that there would always be more. And that made the losing more okay. Why do we send flowers? To make up for what is intangible? Those feelings we can't hold in our hands and present as a gift to our loved ones? And why is it that the placeholders we choose, the dozen red roses, the fragrant white lilies, the long-stemmed French tulips, why is it that they are so fleeting? Hold on to them for too long, and you end up with a mess of petals, pollen, and foul-smelling water. After my boyfriend's death, I went about trying to find closure. I wrote letters and set them on fire. I went to a therapist, then another. I went to yoga, and I tried meditation. I moved to Colorado, then Oregon. I went so many places and carried him along with me to each of them. I have done so much holding. There's a picture I took of him just days before I left for college, 2 months before he died. It was the summer of chips and guacamole dinners we shared sitting on the living room floor. He's standing in the kitchen wearing a white t-shirt and jeans, one perfect half of an avocado cradled in his hand. His face is turned away, hidden from the camera, but I like to think he's smiling. I remember the song we were listening to, the chatter of frogs through the screen door, my bare feet on wood. Precious moments made all the more precious by the fact that they have already come and gone. Now I measure months by what's in season. Sunflowers in July, dahlias in August, rose hips and maple in October, pine in December, hyacinth in March, crowd-pleasing peonies in May. A favorite of mine is tulip magnolia, the way the buds erupt into blooms and the blooms into a litter of color on lawns, all in a matter of weeks while it's snowing cherry blossoms. How startlingly beautiful impermanence can be.
Carrie Bechet, reading Alicia Gorder's essay, One Bouquet of Fleeting Beauty, Please. We talk with Alicia after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When Alicia Gorder's Modern Love essay was published in 2015, she was a bit nervous about how her co-workers at the flower shop would respond. But she didn't have to worry. After the essay appeared, they threw her a party.
They made brunch, and then when I walked in on the table, they had made me this really beautiful bouquet of roses. And, you know, I talk about in the essay how everything was written in shorthand, where thank you would be TY or happy birthday HB. And so they had written this message to me, but everything was in, it was just by letters. So it was this puzzle for me to figure out. And it said WVPOY.
It stood for, we're very proud of you. We will forever miss you at the flower shop. But know you are destined for greatness as a famous writer.
That's an insanely long message.
It's been almost 8 years since her boyfriend died. She's 26 now. For a while, dating was hard.
I think that the first relationship that I had after was particularly challenging. I think just because, you know, that was the only point of comparison that I really had. And I also think it took me a long time to really be ready or willing to address how it would impact or play out in other areas of my life, romantic relationships included, which seems really obvious now that I'm looking at it. But there was a point where I think I just wanted, you know, I really wanted to be okay. And I think I wanted to kind of put it in a box in a way and put it under my bed.
Alicia's new friends were shocked to learn about this part of her life. But writing this essay and the passage of time have helped her to understand the experience.
Since then, it's also just been a matter of figuring out how I can have this story and tell it and, you know, have it be a part of me and a big part of my life and have the people in my life understand it and know about it, but also not let it define me.
Alicia Gorder no longer works at the flower shop, but she does occasionally fill in during the holidays. She's now a book publicist in Portland, Oregon. Coming up, some thoughts from Daniel Jones.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, says he was struck by how Alicia Gorder's essay captured the significance of ephemeral joys.
It ends with this sort of perfectly written sentiment about impermanence and how, you know, startlingly beautiful impermanence can be. And it's the kind of perfect last line that ripples back through the entire story in such a smart and moving way and makes you think about, like, well, what is beauty and what is something of value? And how much does impermanence contribute to that?
Carrie Bechet says that she, too, loved the way Alicia wrote about things that are fleeting.
I think about my job as an actor as kind of this balance of holding on and letting go of things, and I really relate to a desire to hold on to the details and the stories of the people's lives, and still the necessity of letting those things go in order to really appreciate them.
Carrie Bechet. You can see her in the Netflix show Narcos and AMC's Halt and Catch Fire. Next week, Ali Faisal from the new film Victoria and Abdul tells the story of an unlikely pair.
What was confusing, I guess, was not that two people of such different ages had become friends, but that we had essentially become best friends. Others saw our devotion as either strange or quaint, like one of those unlikely animal friendships. A monkey and a pigeon, perhaps.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.